I'm Hadley Race. My basic skill set is as a production engineer, which is producing and making things. I've been in the pharmaceutical industry since 1980, which was the year before the blockbuster industry era started. I spent 16 years working for a large German multinational, manufacturing and distributing drugs around the world. Alka-Seltzer being one, sterile injectables like the vaccines being others. I headed up the global supply chain, and in 1996, I left there and joined the biotech industry. Now, biotech industry is companies who are venture capital-backed developing drugs, and I spent 16 years there. Then I became independent in 2005, and I've been an independent consultant in biopharmaceutical supply chains ever since. And in 2011, Wiley published my book, Supply Chain Management in the Drug Industry, Delivering Patient Value for Pharmaceuticals and Biologics, which was basically a 450-page textbook on the industry and drug development and supply chains and the whole things. And ever since, I've been campaigning for major change in the pharmaceutical industry, root and branch change, because it's become focused on patents that deliver profits rather than patients who need healthcare services.
Okay, so when was it, Hedley, that you first decided, look, actually, I need to branch out on my own and start campaigning? Because obviously, you've been observing this industry on the inside. There must have been some point at which you thought, actually, this is going in the wrong direction. I need to step to one side and start to try and pull the tank around.
Yeah, well, I when I left the industry. My last employer was a company called OSI Pharmaceuticals, working with Genentech in the US. And I worked on the launch of a drug called Tarceva for non-small cell lung cancer, which was a successful launch, and it is on the market now. But because that was in the US and I was in Oxford, they closed the Oxford site, and they gave me the opportunity of either working in the US or becoming independent. I became independent, and I started to try and sell my supply chain services to drug developers. And they all said, look, we're going to make an exit. We're only going to, sell this on to big pharma. So the supply chain doesn't mean anything to us. The only thing we want is clinical data that allows us to sell these drugs onto the big pharma companies. And I realized if I didn't start to send the message that supply chains are vitally important, because that's what the patient receives when they have a medicine, an injection, or whatever, that comes from a long, long supply chain where any mistake along the way could have devastating effect for patients.
You're talking about your book, some might call it the more boring one of your books, but you've also got a book out, haven't you, called Taming the Big Pharma Monster by Speaking Truth to Power. Now, that clearly is a campaigning kind of a title for a book. And it's probably, I think, aimed much more at campaigners and the general public. So can you tell us a bit about what inspired you to get writing that?
Yeah, well, in 2015, actually, I wrote a book before that, which was called Find It, File It, Flog It: Pharma's Crippling Addiction and How to Cure It. So basically, the pharma business model these days is to patent the molecule in discovery research, find it, then get contract manufacturers to develop the drug, manufacture it for clinical trials, and submit that to the regulators for approval. And if they get approval, they're in the flog it stage, where they market the bones out of it to sell to doctors to make sure that it becomes a blockbuster. So it's totally divorced from patient need, from patients. And when I wrote that, there was no interest in it. So 4 years later, I thought, I'm going to have a crack again. And this time it was Taming the Big Pharma Monster. And I also held a conference in Wales called Medicines for the 21st Century, Safe, Better, Cheaper, which really aimed at explaining to the industry how it should modernize and enter the 21st century. Making a medicine is the same as making a car, an aero engine, a silicon chip. You have the various stages of manufacture that take time and need inspection. And a bit like a plane, you have components, and those components have to be developed and designed and included in the product. And there's a misconception in this industry that drugs or medicines just throw themselves in the pharmacy store. And where do they come from? If you ask someone how a drug is made, they've got no idea. It's a very, very complex process, because we have to remember those drugs go inside your body. There's nothing more critical in terms of getting the supply chain right than the manufacture of these drugs. So when companies like Pfizer say, oh, we've developed this in 6 months or 9 months or whatever, that's a complete lie. You know, all they've done is some sort of computer model where they've generated the code for the spike protein. They then have to give that to a contract manufacturer and developer, and they have to do all the work. And typically, historically, it takes between 10 or 12 years before you get a drug to market because of all the checks and balances, the safety, efficacy, and quality checks that you have to do. It's so I've explained it in very simple terms in both those books. And last year I wrote What Patients Need to Know About Pharmaceutical Supply Chains, which is a very easy to understand explanation of how you register drugs, the regulations, the checks and balances, the opportunities to improve, and also the fact that supply chains can kill people. In 2007, heparin, which is a well-known blood thinner, made by Baxter, it killed 9 people, and there were hundreds of adverse events because someone had substituted a toxic material in the supply chain at the very start in place of the original material. And so we know supply chains can kill people if they aren't properly managed. I co-chaired a conference in Cincinnati at Xavier University from 2010 to 2013, which was looking at the issues that stem from the heparin incident I just described. It was co-sponsored by the FDA, and I got to know the Cincinnati inspectors very well. And, you know, those guys, they turn up in their outfits. They've got guns, they've got, you know, sheriff's outfits. They have to enforce the regulations, the laws that you need to make sure that medicines are safe. And in those days, there was a lot of focus on improving regulation. In the last 10 years, it's all disappeared. The regulators have just rolled over, and they don't seem to be doing anything. I mean, in my expert report, I looked at the MHRA, and the skills aren't there to review medicines. The skills just aren't there. With the MHRA, they stopped reviewing medicines in 1995 when it moved to the European Medicines Agency. And in those days, it was located in Canary Wharf in London. Then with Brexit, it moved to the Netherlands, and it's now in the Netherlands. So the MHRA has never reviewed a drug since 1995, but they've conditionally approved these vaccines. And you know, I don't know how they've done it. So I've put that in my expert report that's gone to PGH Law. And I must say, even the European Medicines Agency and the FDA, I just don't know what's happened, but they aren't enforcing the regulations. There've been no inspections on the companies that make these vaccines. Now, it's not the Pfizer and the Johnson & Johnson's and the AstraZeneca that make these vaccines. It's contract manufacturers on a fee-for-service basis. The people I knew, the inspectors, the enforcement people, they don't even report into the board now. There's one lady at the MHRA, I forget her name now, but everything reports into her, and she's only been there 4 years, and she came from the vaccines, from Department of Health and Social Care vaccines group. So she won't have a clue about any of this stuff, and yet almost everyone reports to her. That's in my review. It's just a shell organisation. I don't know what's happened.
Okay, can you tell us a bit about PHJ Law, the people that commissioned this, and why they commissioned it?
Yeah, Philip Hyland is an employment lawyer. God, what a lovely bloke, and what a force to be reckoned with. So he was going to raise an injunction against MHRA on the basis that, I don't know the legal term of it, but they haven't exactly fulfilled their duty. And as he's gone through this, so he's hooked up with Mark Sexton, who's the former ex-police officer, who again is a force of nature, who is collecting evidence on all of this. And Philip has, well, we've joined up with Rainer Fulmich, who is the German lawyer who's investigating this, and Mike Yeadon, who's a former Pfizer executive, who has been, blowing the whistle for a long time. So there's a huge body of people now working together. I've come into this through PH Law, and some of the data analysts have identified that these batches have had a much higher death rate than others, which would suggest that supply chain really has got issues.
Well, yeah, hang on, because a statistician will tell you, Headley, that you get a different distribution anyway. You know, sometimes people just by random coincidence might end up being ill rather than, this being to do with batches. But in a way, I do understand what you're saying, because there's been quite a lot of publicity on the alternative news, none whatsoever in the London media, about this website, How Bad Is My Batch, over the last couple of weeks.
Yeah. Well, I've said to them, look, all we know is there's evidence that something is going wrong in the supply chain. You can't say if it's purposeful or accidental, but what I know about how quickly these vaccines have been rushed through, it's certain there are going to be issues. When you thaw a vaccine from -70, which was the original temperature for the Pfizer vaccine, it can change molecular structure. So it has to be done under controlled conditions. Now, it was done in vaccination centres by people who didn't have a clue what they were doing. You know, the instructions were on the internet. They weren't properly given to them. And I spoke to a lady last week. She's on my Substack. She said the fire service in America, the fire service had thawed the vaccines, and they'd actually administered the vaccine to patients in a Target, the US supermarket, because she saw notices saying, careful, there's a biohazard coming in. I mean, you couldn't make it up. So there's people giving injections with, the frozen vaccines were not finished. They should have been subject to good manufacturing and good distribution regulations, which obviously they weren't. So there were gross non-compliances across all the vaccines in terms of good distribution practice and good manufacturing practice. Those regulations are there because in the past people have died because there weren't proper processes in place. It's a bit like if you're making a plane in the aviation industry, they've got very careful regulations to make sure that before a plane takes off, the pilot has got control of it, and he makes sure that everything, all the stuff we're familiar with, if you've flown. Well, they've just put that in the bin and just sort of, shot the plane up in the air with passengers on without much thought.
Yeah, without proper testing. And we all know what happens if you do that, that the plane is likely to not make it to its destination. You're getting a bit like Jonathan Van Tam with your analogies here, Headley. Anyway, look, Can we get into, I mean, actually probably a little bit more sophisticated than the football ones, but can we get into the meat of your expert report, please? And maybe you can tease out a couple of points that you'd like to make. Now, for anybody that doubts what Headley's saying here, you can just go to the report, and which I'll make sure is up available on our website, at holdingtheline.com. That's holding-the-line.com. That's the website of a group of journalists who are very unhappy about censorship of doctors and about medical information during the COVID pandemic. And also on my own site, which is thisweek.org.uk, which we'll be using. But I mean, could you just take us through a couple of the key points that you've teased out in this fully referenced report of yours?
Yeah, sure, Tony. Yeah. Well, firstly, these injections are known as advanced therapy and medicinal products, and that includes cell therapy, gene therapy, and tissue engineering. These are gene therapies. All four of them are gene therapies. They're also biologics, which means they're living things. So you can imagine that a living thing can die very easily. So any point in the supply chain, it can go all pear-shaped.
That's interesting in itself. Sorry to interrupt, but because, you know, a vaccine has a legal definition. And what you're saying is that these are not vaccines.
No, they're not vaccines. No, they're not vaccines. I think that's well documented, not in the mainstream media, but they're not vaccines. The first gene therapy that came to market is for what they call a CAR T indication, a blood cancer. Kymriah was the first one marketed by Novartis, and if you look at the safety warnings on it about the potential for cytokine release syndrome or cytokine storm, it's quite scary. So these gene therapies have got significant life-threatening side effects associated with them. And the companies making, at least one of the companies making these vaccines make the gene therapy for Novartis. So we know there are significant side effects associated for the fact. So that's the first thing, a biologic. So this typically it takes between 10 and 12 years to get any medicinal product to market, because you have to start off preclinically. You have to start off with a small supply chain just to make enough to do the preclinical studies in animal models. So you make maybe 5 or 10 liters. You send that off to a testing house. They, sadly, I wish this didn't happen, but they test it in animals. And if it works, then obviously it can go to the next stage, which is phase 1 clinical supply. So you make a slightly larger batches. But when you make those, you have to test those again, because every time you scale up a batch, potentially the molecular structure could change. So you have to confirm there'd be no change in the molecular structure. And then as you go to phase 2 and phase 3, you scale up again. But each time you have to be sure you test the product of that supply chain to make sure it is safe. And the way they've designed these vaccines in parallel, they haven't been able to have those controls so that they check, constantly check in, there's been no change in the supply chain. So it is wholly possible that as they've scaled up in the supply chain, they have created toxic batches.
The Pfizer, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson, etc. jabs for COVID, they have all been released under something called an emergency use authorization. And so they don't have to go through the normal checks.
Well, in the UK, it's called a conditional marketing authorization. But it's the same thing. But there's nothing. There's no transparency as to how that works. You have to submit a normal application, which is what they call a marketing authorization application, which gives all the data on preclinical safety data, clinical data, and crucially, what they call chemistry, manufacturing, and controls, which is the supply chain data. So you have to tell the regulator or the suppliers or the specifications or the materials, the development protocols, all the work that went on to prove that drug is safe as it's manufactured. That's the normal way it works. So you have to submit one of they will, all will have submitted one of those, but we don't know. The MHRA have said, we will approve them if we think they're suitable. So it's all behind closed doors. And I would say they have not had time to review the chemistry manufacturing controls to ensure the suppliers, the contract manufacturers are fit for purpose. Don't forget, there've been no inspections due to COVID. There've been no physical inspections. Normally a physical inspection is two qualified inspectors going to site for 4 days, going through the whole site from start to finish. They check all the people's training, the quality system, the whole thing. And only then can they get a license to manufacture that product.
Well, it's all very easy for you to criticise from the sidelines, Hedley. You haven't actually been into these manufacturing plants, but is there any actual evidence that at all that substandard jabs have been being produced there?
I'm not making a judgment on the capability of these companies. What I'm saying is we don't know. And, you know, the inspections that have taken place have been virtual. Now, would you buy a house on a virtual inspection? I don't think you would. You'd want to go there and satisfy yourself. You're not making a judgment that house isn't for me, but you're not making the judgment on limited evidence, which isn't enough to decide. So what I'm saying is that these companies who are making the vaccines, they need to have a manufacturing authorization and they need to have the product added to their license. And to do that, they will have had to have had an inspection, and which is a physical inspection. The inspectors write up a report outlining minor, major, and critical observations. Critical could mean the plant is closed down. Now, none of that has happened. So all I'm saying is, in the olden days, it would be unheard of for a company to have a license to make a product when they hadn't been inspected.
Yeah, well, this is the modern world and an emergency rollout. But, I mean, I suppose kind of supporting your point of view, there have been serious problems with these vaccines in some ways and the jabs. Johnson & Johnson had to recall a load of, in the United States, apparently a massive batch of them where the wrong ingredients managed to get in at some point along the supply chain. And also Moderna, too, have had to recall a lot of their vaccines are following reports of allergic reactions. So one does wonder whether what you're getting actually into your into your muscles, hopefully, not your bloodstream, at the end of the day may be very different from one batch to another.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there was one batch in Japan where there was particulate matter found. And so what I'm saying is, if we don't know, you have to investigate. Now, the yellow card system and the VAERS system in the US is saying there are a lot of people being damaged by these vaccines. Now, I'm not a data analyst, but the people I know and are telling me it's scary. So the first thing you do is say, okay, then we've got to go in and we've got to investigate. And if nothing else, I would say we need to put a halt on the injections and investigate what is going on at the companies that are making them.
Because the very opposite is taking place. You're probably aware of the NHS 100K campaign. Sajid Javid has announced this week there's going to be no holding back on sacking anybody in the National Health Service that hasn't been fully jabbed. Now, quite what that means, it could mean 2 jabs, 3 jabs, 4 jabs, God knows how many jabs, but they're getting the sack. And somewhere between 50 and 100,000 NHS personnel could end up with no job in a couple of months' time.
Yeah, well I'm on Twitter, obviously, and I see it's scary. I mean, it doesn't make any sense, but you know, the government, they have really taken over the role of the pharmaceutical industry. Now, the normal way of drugs getting to market is these companies make them. They then sell them to the wholesalers. The wholesalers sell them to the pharmacies. And then the sort of payment is part of the whole system. It's the established system. Wholesalers are properly trained. Now, with these vaccines, the government have ordered them direct from the manufacturer. So they've circumvented the whole incumbent supply chain, which accounts for the money and the payments. So you have to ask, well, you know, how have these vaccines been paid for? How have people been paid for the work they've done? Because there's no system in place.
Yeah, well, it does sound like there's a real problem with quality control. And the frightening thing is, of course, this is going into people's arms. As our correspondent, Dr. Stanley Laham, the retired immunologist from Florida, said, you cannot de-inject yourself with a jab. But anyway, what is Philip Hyland hoping to achieve legally at the moment? Because now I would say is an important juncture, particularly with so many very conscientious and very intelligent, very knowledgeable healthcare staff in Britain, particularly NHS staff, facing the sack.
Yeah, well, I can't say too much, Tony, because Philip is working with others on the criminal investigation. And from what I hear, they have a mountain of evidence, an absolute mountain of evidence of, you know, wrongdoing. And they've gone quiet for the last couple of weeks because they just have to work on this. So I'm very confident that because what's happened defies gravity. You know, you can't push against nature. You can't say, look, a patient's immune system really isn't good enough. We'll have to inject you four times a year and that'll be fine. You know, that's fully against nature. So, you know, the world, at the end of it, you can't defy Mother Nature. You can't push against Mother Nature. And people are not, you know, people are suffering with these vaccines if you look at the reports. So I'm an eternal optimist, and seeing what's happening now with the cohesion, with people working together with legal skills, with scientific skills. You know, Mike Yeadon, who I find it amazing that someone who was VP of respiratory and allergy for Pfizer globally has been vilified because he supposedly wasn't telling the truth. I mean, God, that guy is a scientific genius. I'm honored now to be in contact with him and talking to him. And I think I can add sort of my supply chain and drug development experience to him and all the other people now who are working together. This is only going one way. This is only going one way. Much of the government and others are pushing against it.
Okay, so can you just tell us anything about your personal experience and those of your friends and family with COVID?
Well, it's strange because my wife and I haven't been vaccinated, obviously. We went to London. My daughter's paid for us to have a break in London. And when we came back, my wife had, it was called COVID, but it wasn't really COVID. It was lethargy, sickness, you know, just not feeling right. And we'd been amongst, this was when lots of people had been vaccinated, and we'd been amongst all these people who'd been vaccinated, and we put it down to the spike protein. We put it down to the fact that we'd suddenly been in London, you know, we'd been in Covent Garden, and we'd been with all these people who'd been vaccinated. And we thought she'd had something that had been passed on by all those people who'd had, you know, vaccination and the spike protein. And I still think that what we're seeing now, this Omicron variant, they're saying it's like the cold, which it probably is. But, you know, people are going down with conditions that are nothing like the original, you know, where people have been intubated at the start. They were filmed in hospitals of people, you know, dying in bed and from all these things. And, you know, there was severe respiratory failure. But what people are calling COVID now is nothing like that. So, you know, COVID was 2 years ago. What, you know, what COVID-19? So that's 2019. What is it now?
Well, that's a good question. What do you think about the bigger picture? What's really going on here? Because a lot of this, you know, on one level, it doesn't make sense. But certainly from, you know, the rollout of vaccine passports, for example, if someone wanted to do that, which they clearly do. And also just simply the money making that's going on. A whole new industry has been created with supposedly an injection which you've got to have every few months ad infinitum for the rest of your life. So what do you think is really going on if you stand back and look at the bigger picture?
Right. Well, bigger picture is in the early 1980s, the pharma companies realized that if you patent a molecule and get it approved, you've got a blockbuster. So it started to outsource its manufacture, its distribution, its drug development. So these days, Big Pharma, all it is an organization that patents molecules based on molecular modeling and then market those that get to market with extreme vigor. And the bit in the middle is outsourced to third parties who are paid on a fee-for-service basis. So they pay an arm and leg to those companies because they can't do it themselves. All the skills have been outsourced. So the problem they've had is fewer and fewer drugs have come to market because they haven't had the proper internal resources to develop drugs. So they've started to focus on rare disease, what they call orphan indications, and cancer, like the CAR-T cancer and gene therapies. And they've had to charge, you know, $250,000 a dose. Silly prices. Excuse me, I just have a drink of water here. to maintain their blockbuster earnings, because the volumes in rare diseases are so low, they've had to charge silly prices. There's a gentleman called David Mitchell in the US who's got blood cancer, who's got a cancer. He's been campaigning a long time. He's chairman of Patients with Affordable Drugs. He's paying $100,000 a year for his cancer treatment. They're keeping him alive. He campaigns a lot. Luckily, he's insured. He can afford it, but so many people can't afford it. So we've got these huge prices being charged because on a volume basis, you know, drugs aren't coming to market. So they have to charge very high prices for these for these drugs. So they're working with, as I say, orphan indications. There's a special regulatory rules for them where because there's so few people who've got these diseases, then they get special dispensation. And the money's been going into orphan indications because it's an easier regulatory terrain. So fundamentally, the industry's been trying to find clever ways to make money with less effort and with less expertise from their side.
So what do we do? This is the question that the public need to know. Who should we be supporting? How, and how can we turn the tank around?
Yeah, well, we have to change patent law. The industry, pharma companies have been gaming patent law for 30 years. Basically, there's an archaic provision in pharmaceutical patent law, chemical patent law, where you can claim a compound as your own, just with a chicken wire diagram of the compound and an explanation as to how it could cure a disease. But you don't really need to prove that it can do that. So we know for every 10,000 patented molecules, only one gets to market. So it's like a game of Russian of roulette, you know, where you patent as many molecules as you can. We know that of the 10,000, 250 go into preclinical development. 245 of those fail. And remember, the animals that are killed, the patients' hopes that are dashed, potentially. And of that five that get into the clinic, four of them fail. So only one gets approved. So again, more patient hopes dashed. And it's basically because there's no real attempt to prototype drugs to make sure you've got evidence that says this drug is going to work. The technology exists. There's things like an organ on a chip where you can test a compound and it'll give an indication of the effect that could have on the body. But the industry is just focused on testing in animals and going through the whole 50-year process they've been in. So
how would you change patent law then?
I've already done a sort of request, which was with Jeremy Hunt, for an inquiry into patent law involving the trade association, et cetera, because the risk reward is unfair at the moment. So you'd have to incentivize these companies to produce more data before they get a patent. And when I say data of how safe it is and potentially how effective it is. So you'd have to prototype your compound and make sure you could make it, make sure that it was safe, and make sure that it was had a certain level of efficacy before you started to develop it. At the moment, we start to put in a full-scale supply chain for clinical trials before we know if the drug has got a future. So it's about focusing on prototyping and building evidence that the drug could work. If we look at, say, insulin, Banting in 2022, they brought insulin to market. They crushed up the pancreas of pigs, and they actually injected it into themselves to prove that it was safe and it was effective. And in those days, doctors were at the heart of drug development, and they were the ones driving it. You look at penicillin with Alexander Fleming. You look at Jonas Salk and the polio vaccine. They all were driving drug development, and they were proving those drugs had a future before a patent was in place.
Okay, so who's driving it now?
the industry driving it's itself. It's almost like in free fall, where they're in this mode of continually patenting molecules and hoping they're going to find one that works and then marketing that. It's there's really it's an issue for the world, because the pharmaceutical companies are not focusing on patients and healthcare professionals. They're purely focused on patents. So in the conference I held in 2019, we had the hashtag patients, not patents. And I think there needs to be a real high level debate, discussion, call it what you will, on the whole way we award patents to pharmaceutical companies.
Okay, Hedley. Well, look, finally, what's your message for those that have already had a jab and don't see any problem with the current system?
That's a good question. Do your research. Do your research. Check out people like Peter McCullough, Pierre Corey, Tess Laurie, Mike Eden, all the real experts who actually, if you talk to them, they will give you the full story, chapter and verse.
And what about following your work? Where can we do that?
Oh, well, I would recommend anyone to, first of all, look up what patients need to know about pharmaceutical supply chains, because that's very easy to read. My favorite is Find It, File It, Flog It, because that explains exactly the industry modus operandi. I have got a Substack now called Inside Pharma, which I'm doing daily updates on. and I'm really sharing everything I know about what's going on. And I'm up to 200 subscribers at the moment, but that doesn't sound a lot, but that's only in a week. And I can guarantee you that you learn more from that than anyone else in the pharmaceutical industry ever knew. And it will give you the background to be able to, you know, make your own informed decisions.
Okay, that's a Substack Inside Pharma with Hedley Reese, HedleyRees. And as Hedley has just said, you'll get more there in a day than you would on the London media, probably in a year, of use and interest to keep you alive. Hedley Reese, thanks very much for joining us.
Tony, you're very welcome. It's been great speaking to you. Take care.